The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Greetings, scribes. This week's episode of The Writer Files is brought to you by New Media Dojo. Thinking about starting a podcast or just want to up your sound quality? Make a sound impression with New Media Dojo and inquire today about all of your podcast production needs. Just head over to newmediadojo.com to talk podcast. That's newmediadojo.com.
I don't write historical fiction because my books aren't set in kind of, you know, they're not set around World War II or they're not period fiction or whatever. But equally, like, setting a book in rural Ireland in 1996, like, it may as well have been, you know, the distant past or a different country. You know, I, like, at that point, I was 8 years old. I lived in a suburb of Dublin. Like, I didn't know anything about farms or cows or the IRA or BSE or, you know, I didn't know anything about that. I had no firsthand experience. So the degree of research that I was required to do, the book may as well be set in like Sweden in the 1850s. You know what I mean?
And welcome back to The Writer Files. This is your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you more pages, patience and perseverance, per usual. Award-winning Irish author Ruth Gilligan spoke to me about researching the Gothic wilds of Ireland, how to engineer a thriller, and her latest, The Butcher's Blessing. Ruth is a writer and academic from Dublin and was the youngest person ever to top the Irish bestsellers list. She's published 5 books, and her most recent novel, The Butcher's Blessing, is described as a haunting and unforgettable thriller brimming with secrecy, tradition, and superstition. It won the 2022 Ondaatje Prize, and judges called it a page-turning roller coaster of a read. Barnes & Noble Reads called the book an achingly beautiful novel of family tradition, Ireland, and the deep secrets buried in all three. Ruth contributes literary reviews to the Irish Independent, Guardian, TLS, and the LA Review of Books. She's also a professor of creative writing at the University of Birmingham and is an ambassador for the global storytelling charity Narrative 4, linked in the notes. In this file, Ruth and I discussed how a high school writing exercise turned into a bestseller, the in-depth 4-year research process behind her latest, why her meticulous plotting is like architectural engineering, how to write a thriller from 4 unique POVs, why writers always need to set themselves greater challenges, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. A huge shout out to those of you who have already donated or purchased Writer Files merch. And I wanted to personally thank supporters David Anderson and Hubbub Media this week. You're helping keep the lights on, literally. I'm cooking up some new collaborations and sponsors for the show in 2022, so stay tuned. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. Okay, we are back on The Writer Files. I am honored today to be joined by the award-winning author and academic Ruth Gilligan is joining us today. How are you surviving there? I believe you're overseas in the UK presently.
Yeah, I'm currently in London. So I literally got home last night after doing a week back in Dublin and then a few days in Essex, which is where my husband's from. So yeah, we've done the rounds of all the family ever. So I'm now back in my apartment in London and just breathing a little sigh of relief that we managed to do it all without anyone getting sick and anything going wrong. So yeah, it's a lot of relief.
Fantastic. Yeah, it must feel good to be back home safe and sound. Exactly. And yeah, we can't wait to pick your brain about all things writing. So as we do, and before we talk about your latest, The Butcher's Blessing, as it's titled here in the US, let's talk about just your history as a writer. And, you know, you've had this fantastic career, and you've worn all these different hats. You're kind of a multi-hyphenate, as I like to put it, academic. You've been an actor and, of course, award-winning author. But take us back a little bit to, I don't know, maybe when you had an aha moment that you were going to venture kind of down this road of literary fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard for me because I feel like I sort of stumbled into writing, and that it's something that I always did and always loved, but I started really early, like in the way that so many people do. Like, I wrote a lot as a youngster, and then, you know, basically at the age of 16 I had to do a high school project, so I decided I would write a novel. So I wrote my first novel at 16 purely because it was something I had to do for school. And then through a series of like freakishly fortunate events, it ended up getting published, and it ended up going to number one on the bestsellers list in Ireland. And I was like, oh my goodness, I suddenly am an author. So there was nothing kind of massively deliberate about it. It all sort of right place, right time, just kind of happened. And then, you know, after that, I published two more novels. And, you know, those first three books were kind of super commercial, kind of somewhere between kind of YA and commercial women's fiction, like all about young people in Ireland coming of age, doing stupid stuff, finding themselves, etc. But I guess it was after those first three books that, as I said, sort of happened without me fully realizing what the hell was going on. I was like, oh, wait, I actually want to be a writer full time, but, you know, maybe these aren't necessarily the kinds of books that actually I want to write going forward. So I actually ended up taking like a pause of like 7 years and went away and did a creative writing master's and then a PhD and then sort of switched direction. And then my fourth and fifth books came out in kind of 2016 and 2020 respectively. So that for me was the moment I kind of consciously decided I want to be a writer and this is the kind of book I want to write. But it also happens that I already had three published novels under my belt as well. So there's kind of two stages to the journey as I kind of envisage it, which is kind of unusual, I guess.
Yeah, that's really cool. That kind of evolution, taking time to really study the craft, obviously paid off. And I understand that you won the 2021 Ondaatje Prize, which must have been, I don't know, it must have felt like, this is what I've been working towards.
Sure. I mean, like, you know, winning prizes, we all know that it's a lottery. And when we don't win them, we're like, oh, it's all to do with luck and who knows who and blah, blah, blah. But then when you do win one, you're like, oh my God, they mean everything. So I feel like for two reasons, like one, because of the journey that I've just articulated, it does feel like a lovely kind of confirmation that like, yes, you've done it. You have officially become a literary writer, whatever the hell that means. So that was really nice. It was also just nice because like the book first came out here, The Butchers, as it's called in the UK and Ireland, like it first came out here in March 2020, which I can officially confirm is the worst time ever in history to publish a novel. And yeah, it was the poor little thing. It just, the timing was so bad. And I mean, it was right at the start of the pandemic when like literally up until like a week before what was supposed to be an in-person book launch, like we naively thought like that might still be a thing. And it was just like literally the week of publication, the world was just falling apart before our eyes. And needless to say, nobody wanted to think or talk about books. And, you know, a lot of places, especially in Ireland, like a lot of bookstores like hadn't figured out online retail whatsoever. So like there was a point that like you physically couldn't get your hands on a copy of the book. Like it was getting reviewed in like the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, but like I was getting texts from like friends and family being like, I really want to buy your book, but like I literally can't. And like as an author, that is like pretty crushing. So the point is that like fast forward a year later for it to win a prize, it's just nice for it to get some like belated love and attention, because I did feel like, yeah, it had sort of fallen through the cracks, totally understandably, because we all had bigger things to be worrying about. But yeah, it was nice just to get a little belated boost.
Yeah, absolutely. And now it's available in paperback. That must be another nice confirmation. there. Just some really amazing blurbs and a lot of great reviews. But The Butcher's Blessing here in the U.S. has been called gripping, gothic, and moody, and achingly beautiful novel of family tradition, Ireland, and the deep secrets buried in all three. But yeah, you know, there's definitely a host of influences happening here. And I really do want to talk about the unique research process that you went through to kind of capture, you know, the essence of place, and then of course the characterization that went into this fantastic book. Talk a little bit about, yeah, this this process for you.
Yes, I mean, for me, the big difference between the kind of the books that I used to write and the books that I write now is to do with the research process. Like, I am kind of, you know, an unashamed nerd who really enjoys research and probably enjoys it too much so that I never really know when to stop. So I kind of keep going and keep going, and then I just have folders and folders that I never end up using. But, you know, I knew that I wanted to write a book that was set in 1996 in Ireland during the BSE or mad cow disease crisis. Along the kind of Northern Irish border. And like, it's so funny because sometimes when people ask me what kind of books I write, you know, I don't write historical fiction because my books aren't set in kind of, you know, they're not set around World War II, or they're not period fiction or whatever. But equally, like, setting a book in rural Ireland in 1996, like, it may as well have been, you know, the distant past or a different country. You know, I, like, at that point I was 8 years old. I lived in a suburb of Dublin. Like, I didn't know anything about farms or cows or the IRA or BSE, or, you know, I didn't know anything about that. I had no firsthand experience. So the degree of research that I was required to do, the book may as well be set in like Sweden in the 1850s, you know what I mean? So I went really deep, and I'm a big believer in kind of doing, just there's so many different types of research one can do. Like, obviously, you know, spending days and days in the library and reading old books and old records, but then also like going to the place. Like, I spent a lot of time in you know, what are known as the border counties, so the counties along the Northern Irish border, just spending time walking around, just soaking it up in. It's such a weird, liminal, abandoned part of the world. Then, like, talking to people, interviewing farmers, like, going to their farms, spending time there, asking them what they probably thought were, like, the most inane, stupid questions, because I literally know nothing about farms. Listening to radio on repeat. Like, I used to just listen to farming shows, and also, like, radio shows, you know, local radio run out of Cavan and Monaghan and those kind of different counties, just to get the accent and the cadence of the speech. So yeah, just like all these different types of research to really immerse myself in, like, the texture, I suppose, of that time. Because as I said, yes, there are things I remember from 1996. I remember the Spice Girls releasing their first single, and I remember the Olympics, and I remember the football tournament that was going on, and, you know, the couple of people who died or whatever. But like, in terms of what was going on in that particular corner of Ireland, as I said, I was a complete novice. So yeah, I really, really went deep. But I love that. I love geeking out on research. And to be honest, like, my one of my editor's main jobs is just to rein me in and be like, Ruth, I know you think this like passage is super interesting. It has absolutely no bearing on the story, the characters, the plot. And I'm like, but it's so cool. And he's like, no, Ruth, remove it. So yeah, that's the kind of the biggest thing for me that I need to learn.
Amazing. Yeah, so I understand that you did just an extensive amount of research. And then, of course, you've got to synthesize all of this into, you know, what's being called as kind of a both literary thriller, coming of age story. As you mentioned, some historical, quite a bit of historical fiction paints these scenes. And then you have the kind of the folklore and the superstition and supernatural piece. And we won't do any spoilers here, but talk about then sitting down and, kind of what, like, when you're really hitting your stride, when you're kind of in that flow state, what the most prolific period for you is, when you're, you know, feeling really, really confident about where your head hit.
I mean, I'd love to think that that moment ever comes. I'm kind of fascinated about this concept of the flow state, because I kind of feel like I hear people talking about this, and I love the sound of it, but I'm not sure it's something that I like totally recognize in myself. I think, like, as I said, like, not only am I a massive geek and a nerd when it comes to research, but I'm also like, I'm a planner. Like, I am an intensely, like, I'm not a very chill person. I'm like highly organized. I like lists. I like plans. I like structure. And, you know, fundamentally, I write novels that usually have multiple points of view and therefore multiple storylines. So, like, I planned with an inch of my life. Mm. Like, I spend so long, like, and I force myself to stay on the in the planning stage for as long as possible, because I know from experience that if I do kind of just say, okay, I have a rough idea what's going to happen, I'm just going to start writing and see where it takes me, mm-hmm. I'll just go off on some tangent, I will just lose my thread, I will just, yeah, it doesn't work for me. So I need to have, I spent ages on kind of the architecture or the engineering part of the process. And again, I love it. Like, I love having a really detailed, like, you know, blocking out almost like a beat mm-hmm. sheet for a film or whatever, like what's going to happen in each chapter, what are the revelations, what key scenes need to happen, what beats I need to hit. And once I spent a very, very long time planning that out. And then when I come to writing, like, yeah, sure, there's like, you know, there's a certain amount of flow and pleasure and, you know, leaning in, you know, that's the bit where you get to play with language and, you know, something that I really love. But also I'm always have one eye on that plan, being like, okay, I've got 4,000 words, I need to do X, Y, Z, like, go. So I just know that I have to rein myself in, because otherwise I would just go off in all sorts of directions. And especially for something, you know, The Butchers, as I said, has kind of four key points of view. There's like a central, you know, it is loosely structured around a kind of a whodunit. Like, there's a, you know, there's a dead body, and the kind of central question is, you know, whose body is it and how did he die? Mm-hmm. So in terms of planting all the clues and the slow release of information over the course of the novel, like, that had to be so meticulously worked out and shared between the four points of view. So yeah, this kind of casual flow state sounds great, but is kind of anathema to me.
Mm-hmm. And then talk about the importance of the gamut of revision and editing that you went through to, you know, finally arrive at this polished, award-winning book.
Yeah, I mean, my editor is exacting. And I love that about him. Like, he really puts me through my paces, and I really, really love that about him. I think the editorial process for me is like my favorite part of the whole novel, because you basically get someone really clever, reads your book, and then tells you all these things that you were doing that you didn't even realize you were doing, and then makes all these suggestions about how to make the book even better. And like, I'm blessed also with having like a really great UK editor and a great US editor. So between them, their combined wisdom. So I'm very unprecious about, like, if they say this scene is rubbish or this character isn't working, or, you know, I'm totally happy to kind of respond to their suggestions and go with that. And I think, you know, I think with this novel, I think they thought it would require one, maybe two edits. And I remember at the second round of edits, my British editor turned around to me and he's like, Ruth, it is nearly there, but it's just not quite there. So I'm going to make you do another round. And I remember at the time being like, James, I hate you. Why are you doing this to me? And I'm actually, in retrospect, I'm obviously so, so glad he did, because, you know, why get that far in the process and not make it the best it can possibly be? So yeah, I as I said, I actually love the editorial process, because you just get super smart people. Like, it feels like cheating to me, because you just got super smart people being like, here are some ideas to make your book even better. And you're like, wow, is it okay for me to just take these and use them? Like, it just feels naughty. But yeah, no, I really love it. And as I said, for me, like, for this novel, it, like, a lot of it was to do with, yeah, removing the kind of where there was too much research, or, you know, as I said, there's four points of view, and there was a sense all along that, like, one of the four, like, wasn't working as well as the other three. So then, you know, there's a question about, do we cut it, or do we just make, you know, work on it to bring it up and make it as strong as the others? And, you know, there was a couple of things where, like, there's one kind of key scene in the middle, which is like a big fight scene in a pub, which ultimately leads to the murder that, as I said, the whole novel is centered around. Mm-hmm. And that pub scene originally was told from one point of view, but my editor was like, I think it would be better from the different character's point of view, which is all well and good, but then because the thing is so meticulously plotted, it required this big, you know, has this big domino effect, because you then have to move things around and you then have this gap. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of it felt very fiddly and very you know, you dismantle the whole thing and you're like, oh god, it'll never go back together, but then it does. So yeah, I love the editorial process, and I'm really lucky with both my editors that they're very exacting, but they're very, very good. So happy days.
That's cool. So they kind of explode it and put it back together, and of course it turns out beautifully. Hey, I just want to take a quick break for my podcast recommendation for this week. Have you run out of interesting things to say to friends when you actually get to see them? Then take a listen to the Book Dreams podcast. Each week, co-hosts Julie Sternberg and Eve Yohalem use books to explore fascinating questions like, what happened when a Harvard professor staked her reputation on an alleged Gospel of Jesus's wife that turned out to be fake? How did debut author Tom Lin save the American Western by blowing it to bits? Are pigeons rats with wings or wonder birds? And what's the who, when, where, how, and especially why of books bound in human skin? Recent and upcoming Book Dreams highlights include conversations with Disha Filya, award-winning author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Catherine Schultz, and neuroscientist and dreams researcher Siddhartha Ribeiro. You can subscribe and listen to Book Dreams wherever you get your podcasts. But yeah, talk a little bit about, you obviously didn't have to research the pub fight piece because you've been in a lot of those, I'm sure. But
a seasoned fighter.
Are you a coffee or a tea drinker?
Both. In excess. Yeah.
I'm just checking. talk a little bit about your next kind of literary adventure, what you're planning next. I understand that you're already working on something, but talk about kind of now the transition into something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, being completely honest, I do feel like a little bit of a fraud being on this podcast right now, being like, I'm going to talk about my secrets to writing. Because at the moment, I'd say I'm having a little bit of a like, I don't know if I know how to write books anymore moment. So I have a first draft of the next thing, but it's currently not working. But I think I'm starting just in the last couple of weeks to see a way through. I don't know what it is. I feel like weirdly, each novel, I sort of almost set myself a challenge. Like I set myself a set of parameters within which to write the next book. So like for some reason, despite everything that I've just said to you, like I am determined that my next book will only have one point of view, which is very different from the last few. I'm also determined that it won't be set in Ireland, which is very different from the last two. So I have all these things, these kind of non-negotiables that just make my life misery, which I don't know why I'm doing it to myself, but I have this thing in me that I want to challenge myself. I don't want to just keep writing the same book, and I want to be learning and developing as a writer. So yeah, I am currently wrangling with a novel which only has one point of view, although in an elaborate ruse to like circumnavigate my own parameters, I have it so that it jumps around a lot in time. So it's almost like getting multiple POVs, but it's just the same character at different stages in her life. It's set in Scotland, not Ireland, so it's like different, but you've still got some like lovely moody landscape. I seem to just be determined to set myself all these kind of like challenges and devising workarounds to like circumnavigate my own challenges, which is a really bizarre way to approach the task. But yeah, as I said, I wrote a first draft. I showed it to my agent, who was very politely, like, some of this is good and some of this isn't. Go away and think about it. And I feel like I've been thinking about it for like slightly too long, but, you know, between pandemic and, you know, I teach full time as well. So it's just, my brain has not been there, but I feel like, I don't know, I'm also very, I get very kind of philosophical around this time of year. I love New Year's resolutions. I'm a big believer in kind of starting afresh and setting new goals, etc. So I think I am starting to feel like I see a way through. So I'm really hoping that 2022 will be a good writing year. And if I say it often enough, it will happen.
That's great. I think that's a great way to kick off 2022. I think you're in good company because, well, I mean, many of us have been through challenging times these last couple of years, and writers are only human, as I understand it. But yeah, it's actually refreshing to hear a writer say, you know, that they are human, that they are running up against roadblocks, that they're not just cranking out, you know, three books a year and hitting all the lists, and you know, so many of the well-known writers that we talk about this same kind of challenge. Like, each book is like, wait, shouldn't I be better at this time around? Shouldn't I be actually improving at this task? But so many so many feel the same way.
I totally agree. And it doesn't get easier. And I think, you know, in a way I recognize that, like, if I were just going to write like a variation on the theme or try and write a pretty similar book, like maybe it would be a bit easier. But I do think it's important to kind of keep challenging yourself and keep trying to do something new. But yeah, there is something a bit like, I mean, I kind of love and hate it when authors compare writing a book to giving birth, because as I understand it, the two are wildly different. But I do think it's really funny how, like, women talk about the fact that, like, they can't remember the actual labor process because your body forces you to forget it, because otherwise you would never do it again. And I kind of feel like at this moment in time, I'm like, I don't remember having this period of like wild uncertainty and existential crisis with the other books. But my husband is like, oh no, you did. I remember this really well. It's awful. But like, in a way, it's reassuring that like I was here before and I did manage to produce novels at the end of it. So I just kind of, you know, you slightly need to trust the process and just be like, this is part of it, even though it feels kind of horrific.
Interesting. Well, yeah, it's nice to hear. And imposter syndrome is a pretty common piece, especially amongst really, really talented and very well-regarded authors. And yeah, I think that piece that you mentioned about setting the bar a little bit higher for yourself each time. I mean, you must find it, I mean, there's a meta piece to this because you're teaching creative writing. Is that true? And so sometimes you must be teaching it and thinking to yourself, oh, am I following the same advice?
Yeah, I really feel that. And I've really felt that actually this semester. Like, I've got, you know, yeah, so I teach creative writing full time at the University of Birmingham. And, you know, like at the moment I'm supervising 10 final year students who are working on their dissertation. And like, I have, you know, I made this schedule for them. So like each fortnight they need to be producing this many words and they're like working on their ideas and I've got them to do plans and structures. And like, each of them has just sent me 3,000 words to read over the break. And like, I was just reading some of them before I came on the call, but I'm kind of like, huh, I'm like handholding these people to, you know, write their novels. And yet secretly that I sit down to write my own at the moment and I'm like, ah, can't do it. So yeah, I do feel, it feels kind of odd being like, am I being a hypocrite? But I do, like, I don't know, I find it hard to do. Like, I think I love my job, but I do think that like the teaching and the writing definitely feed into each other big time, because it's just an excuse basically to be reading and talking and thinking about writing all the time, which is lovely. But I think in terms of like literally at the same time, I find it quite hard. Like, I feel like during term time and while I'm teaching, I find it very hard to then just switch into writer mode, like in the afternoons or just for like an hour here and there. Like, I tend to do most of my writing like in the holidays or over the summer, or like I've got like a semester of, of research leave coming up next year. And that is when I think I will finally finish a new draft of this book. Because, yeah, at the moment, I'm just so invested in my students' projects that I feel like just quite hard to get some headspace for my own.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Well, we value your time and your wisdom. Before we wrap up with kind of your advice to fellow scribes, I've got one fun one for you. Of course, we will point at your home base there, which is ruthgilligan.com. The book is The Butcher's Blessing here in the U.S., and it's been called an achingly beautiful novel of family tradition, Ireland, and the deep secrets buried in all three. That what Colin McCann said was very nice. Gilligan braids beauty and brutality together in a seamless literary thriller. Some nice, very nice words there from your colleague. But yeah, anywhere else you want to point listeners to kind of connect with you before we wrap up here?
My only social media is Twitter. So I'm just at Ruth Gilligan. I never succumbed to Instagram, and I stepped away from Facebook a few years ago and haven't looked back. So yeah, Twitter is my only vice. But yeah, say hi. Okay.
Very good. All right. Fun one. If you could have dinner with any author from any era, to your favorite spot in the world, all expenses paid, of course, who would you take and where would you take them? Not to put you on the spot at all.
No, not in the slightest. I mean, I feel like it's really cliche for me to say James Joyce, but I just kind of like to meet the chap because he seems really odd. And I'd say he's like uber eccentric. I would say like kind of current living hero would be like someone like Anne Enright, the Irish author. But I did actually get to meet her a while ago. I did an event with her, and I was so wildly inarticulate because I just was so in awe of her, and she's just like insanely formidable. And I was like, I want to be you when I grow up. So maybe if we went for dinner and there was wine, I would be a bit more chill, and we could like do that conversation from the top. So yeah, I'd say Anne Enright if you fancy dinner.
Okay, well, you can bring both. You know, because
yeah, okay, cool.
We're getting in the time machine or whatever. And so where would you take James and Annie?
James and Anne, where would we go? Well, it would have to be somewhere, I feel like, in Ireland. So, you know, maybe somewhere, some nice restaurant in Dublin overlooking the sea. We could have some sea fish and some wine. It'd be lovely.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right. So if you have just a pearl of wisdom for fellow scribes on just how to keep going, how to persevere through the tough times, what would you drop on them?
Honestly, I would just say, if in doubt, go back to your plan. I feel like that is the one thing that if it's not feeling like an inspiration day and the words aren't coming, I just feel like going back to that plan and tinkering with it and thinking a bit more about the architecture of your novel, that's really, really useful work and will stand you in good stead. So I feel like on the days that you don't feel uber creative in terms of putting pretty language on the page, the behind the scenes stuff is just as vital and appeals to a slightly different side of your brain.
Lean on the work and then rely on the craft later on. And we really appreciate your time and your wisdom. And thanks for dropping in here to do this today.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.